Good morning. You are listening to Raven Radio. Today is Tuesday, May 21st, 2013. I'm Holly Keene, and this is Raven News. Sitka's community food survey has been extended until the end of the month in hope of attracting more participants. Organizers say over 400 Sitkins have taken the survey online or on paper at the library, but they'd like to get to 600 or more. The goal is to understand how prepared Sitkins are to face rising food prices or to ride out an emergency like last January's earthquake and tsunami. KCAW's Robert Woolsey spoke with a member of the Food Security Task Force and filed this report.
The magnitude 7.5 earthquake that rocked southeast Alaska on January 4th did not produce coastal flooding anywhere near the scale of the Japanese tsunami the previous year. But you have to admit, for about 45 minutes, many of us wondered if this finally was the big one. It wasn't, but Lisa Sadler-Hart says we should be thinking now about the next one.
Just like you think about electricity in this town, you should also be thinking about food.
Sadler-Hart sits on the Food Security Task Force, which was formed at last fall's Community Health Summit. Before the earthquake, it was primarily about the economics of the food supply. According to the University of Alaska Cooperative Extension Services quarterly food cost survey, food prices in Sitka rose 44% between 2006 and 2011. Now, Sadler-Hart says the task force is interested in a more three-dimensional picture of food in Sitka.
It's going to give us, I think, a really good sense of what's going on multiple levels. One is, how food secure our households. So are people struggling with these increased food prices that we're seeing in our community? Are people out gathering and harvesting the foods that are available to us locally, whether that's seafood or game or the plants and berries that are around here? Also, how much food do folks have on store? You know, we had that big scare back in January, and I think it was an awakening to many of us that we are not fully prepared.
The survey takes about 10 minutes to complete, but Sadler-Hart says the data collected will be the cornerstone of developing food policy in Sitka. Some of that policy may involve warehousing more of our regular groceries above sea level. Some of it may be creating a culture of personal preparedness.
You know, we are a tsunami-ready community. I guess I would challenge people, are you a tsunami-ready household? And really, we've got to be thinking about having enough food for at least 7 days. And I do realize that, you know, for some of us, that's not a problem, to be able to add those extra stores and have them in storage. Folks that are living, though, in a small apartment may not be able to accommodate that, might need to find somebody else that's got a larger household and storage to hold on to some of that food for them. We also know we've got significant number of households that are struggling financially, and so they may also not be able to provide for themselves. So it's something that we need to be thinking about, I think, on a larger scale.
Sadler-Hart says the task force would like another few hundred Sitkins to take the survey. This November, when everyone's mind is already on food, the task force will plan a food summit to present the data and to develop action steps. Sadler-Hart is a public health nutritionist and a registered dietitian, and she practices what she preaches. Her own lawn is now a garden, and what her family can't eat, she shares with others at the local farmers market. She thinks the link between public health and food policy has been neglected too long.
I've been very, very concerned about our food system in the United States, in the state of Alaska, and in our community. It's become very apparent to me that we don't have a sustainable food system.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
You can find the Sitka Food Security Survey online at kcaw.org, or you can drop by Kettleson Library and fill out a hard copy. In 1830, President Andrew Jackson signed the Indian Removal Act into law. The measure allowed him to negotiate the movement of Native Americans from the southern states to west of the Mississippi River. And the policy laid out the groundwork for the Trail of Tears, a forced march of Cherokees out of northern Georgia, which took place after Jackson's presidency. Last week in Sitka, the former president went on trial before a jury of eighth graders. KCAW's Ed Ronco reports.
We are in the library at Blatchley Middle School, which is temporarily arranged like a courtroom. The lawyers, the judge, the jury, and most of the witnesses here are all about 14 years old. Court comes to order, and 8th grade social studies teacher Roxanne Gagner, playing the role of bailiff, swears in a witness.
Do you swear that the testimony you're about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
The witness, President Andrew Jackson, is nervous. It is his fourth time testifying that day. He's already been shredded by two prosecutors, and as he sits down to testify again, he hopes he knows how to answer his own lawyer's questions. I know this because, well...
Mr. Andrew Jackson.
Counselor.
I am playing Andrew Jackson.
Do you believe that the Cherokee were obligated to follow the laws of Georgia?
That Matlockian voice belongs to Colton Cummins, age 14, and one of my defense attorneys in the case. He paces back and forth as he conducts his questioning.
When did the Trail of Tears happen, actually?
The policy of the Indian Removal Act took place during my administration, but the actual carrying out...
And let me just say, sticking up for Andrew Jackson and answering these questions as he might is not easy. Neither is facing the prosecutors. They go for the jugular and ask me, well, they ask President Jackson exactly what his problem is with Native Americans.
What makes them different from any other man or woman or child?
I don't know.
No further questions.
Cassie Pitzer was one of the many prosecutors to put me in the hot seat on the stand. She says she wants to be an attorney when she grows up.
Because I've always been really good at arguing with people. So I was actually really excited to play this role. I was just ready to kick some butt.
And you did?
Yes, I did.
What was it like to stump me?
It felt really good. I was really proud of myself. Like, I'm going to go call my mom right now.
Really?
Yeah.
And tell her what you did?
Yeah, I'm really excited.
And they've had to do their own research. This is not scripted.
That's Roxanne Gagner, the teacher. She says teaching this part of American history as a trial requires the students to not just memorize the information, but apply it, actually know what they're talking about.
The lawyers are creating their own questions. The witnesses are looking at the biographies of the people that they are playing and pulling out the pertinent information that will determine the outcome of the trial.
And all of the students are learning a thing or two about the American legal system, in addition to the Indian Removal Act. They're expected to follow the procedures of a trial and to exercise courtroom decorum. Of course, one judge did have to try his entrance again after high-fiving a defense attorney on the way to the bench, and another lawyer was excused from court after a particularly robust belch. But all of them presented passionate, logical, well-researched arguments on both sides.
And it's so appropriate at this age level because they realize that things aren't just black and white.
And that leads to a serious point. During the particular incident these students are studying, some 15,000 Cherokee were forced to leave Georgia. More than 4,000 of them died along the way. Saying it was a brutal experience and that conditions were difficult is, at the very best, an understatement. Gagner says her students are having fun with the trial, but that they also understand the gravity of what happened.
With all of the situations that we've looked at with U.S. history or any people's histories, there's always those really difficult, horrendous situations of how people treat each other. The students also, earlier in the year in their English class, their language arts class, they studied the Holocaust. So they did have background information on human atrocities that they did apply to this court case as well.
In all, five classes put me on trial as Andrew Jackson. Three of the juries acquitted Jackson, arguing that he should not be blamed for events that happened during Martin Van Buren's presidency. And two classes, well...
We, the members of the jury, have found Andrew Jackson guilty.
Oh.
Oh.
History is many things to many people, but today it is not boring. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
Tennessee Alaska shareholders are challenging four incumbents for the Regional Native Corporation's Board of Directors. That is the largest number of independent candidates in 5 years, although some earlier ballots came close. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports from Juneau.
Proxy statements, which include ballots, were sent to Sea Alaska shareholders earlier this month. Voting runs through a couple days before the corporation's annual meeting, June 20th in Hoonah. Proxies can be mailed, faxed, or dropped off in person. Corporate Secretary Nicole Hollingstad says online voting has become increasingly popular.
The first year of online voting, about 11% of our shareholders voted online. The second year, that rose just a little bit to 13%. We're early in the proxy process, so it's impossible at this point to say where that final percentage will fall, but higher levels than that have already come in through online voting for this year's proxy season.
This year's online voting is done through a new shareholder information system called MySeaAlaska. The secure site also includes stock information and dividend payment history. No resolutions are on this year's ballot. Prior year's measures addressed term limits, discretionary voting, and stock for shareholder descendants. Tribal members can vote a specific number of shares for each candidate they support, or they can vote discretionary, turning their ballots over to the board, which supports its own members. Most of this year's 14 board candidates are in their 50s, 60s, or 70s, but three are between 30 and 40. Hollingstad, also Vice President of Communications, says that includes last year's appointed youth representative on the SeaAlaska board.
This year's slate does include some of our younger shareholders, and it's great to see that successive generations of shareholders for SeaAlaska are seeing this as a mechanism to serve the Native community.
SeaAlaska added several thousand younger shareholder descendants after a 2007 vote. The regional Native corporation is headquartered in Juneau and has more than 21,000 shareholders. Most are of Tlingit, Haida, or Tsimshian descent. Close to half live in Southeast.
And that's all for Raven News. If you've missed any of our stories or would like to hear them again, please visit us online at kcaw.org. You're listening to Raven Radio, KCAW in Sitka.